Church Life Today podcast is a production of Redeemer Radio and the McGrath Institute for Church Life at the University of Notre Dame, and is brought to you in part by Notre Dame FCU and our listeners.
Welcome to Church Life Today, a production of the McGrath Institute for Church Life at the University of Notre Dame. I'm your host, Leonard DiLorenzo. Do you want to know when human life begins and how to explain that to other people? That's what I'm going to ask our guest today, Dr. Maureen Condick, Associate Professor of Neurobiology and Anatomy at the University of Utah Medical School. In 2015, Dr. Condick was appointed to the Pontifical Academy for Life, a distinguished group of physicians, scientists, and theologians from the international community whose mission it is to study questions and issues regarding the promotion and defense of human life from an interdisciplinary perspective. 3 years later, in 2018, Dr. Condick received a presidential appointment to the National Board of Science, the oversight body for the National Science Foundation. Her research focuses on the development and regeneration of the nervous system, spinal cord repair and regeneration, and embryonic development, while she cultivates a strong commitment to public education and science literacy. In June 2019, she delivered the St. Albert Award Lecture at the annual convention of the Society of Catholic Scientists. Welcome to the show.
I'm thrilled to be here.
As I mentioned in the intro, you're quite committed to improving public education and science literacy, one of your great interests. So I'd like to begin with a question that brings together, well, on the one hand, your own research, and on the other hand, an issue of great public interest, but not necessarily of clear public knowledge. How about that? And it's this question, a broad question, a basic question, but an important question. When does human life begin?
You know, this is, as you say, a question that's extremely important for public policy, for research policy, and one that has a surprisingly straightforward scientific answer, despite the fact that many people will claim it's above their pay grade. we know a lot about early development, and to answer the question of when human life begins, we first need to answer the question of when in the interaction of a sperm and an egg cell we get a new kind of cell. So long as sperm and egg or the gametes persist, we can't possibly have a new human being. Mm-hmm. And we have really clear criteria for this in science. Throughout the scientific enterprise, people identify new cells by two simple criteria. So changes in how the cell behaves, or changes in what the cell's made out of, most typically changes in utilization of genes. Mm-hmm. And often those things will go together. If you change what a cell's made out of, you can expand or contract or alter its behavioral repertoire. So based on those two criteria, it's absolutely unambiguous and uncontested that a new cell with new molecular properties and new behavior comes into existence in the instant of sperm-egg membrane fusion, which is an event that takes about a quarter of a second, 250 milliseconds to complete. So there's an instant where we get a new cell, and it has now all the components of both sperm and egg, so it's novel molecular composition, and it very rapidly, within 1 to 3 seconds, alters its behavior in a pretty dramatic way and starts acting in ways that neither sperm or egg ever act. So we have a new cell in that instant.
In that instant. So would it be incorrect then to say you have a fertilized egg?
No, actually that's it's a commonly used term, but it's scientifically completely inaccurate. So an egg that has been fertilized is a new kind of cell that behaves in ways that are actually quite contradictory to the major functions of an egg cell, and that are never seen in egg cells that have not been fused to a sperm. So we have a new cell, but the challenging question for the bigger policy question is, what kind of cell is it?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a human cell? Or is it a human being?
Right.
Much less a human person, which is a separate question.
Right.
And that's a tougher question to answer.
Is this where the disputes really come? I mean, are we at least disciplined enough in scientific inquiry and when it comes to public policy to say there's a new thing here and we can all agree to that? There's a new cell at this moment. And so what is the status of that? Or are we still in the position of questioning whether it's a new thing at all?
I think a lot of that depends on how honest people are willing to be. And I think we've had a reassuring trend in the last 10 years or so that most people, most biologists are willing to acknowledge it's a new cell and willing to acknowledge that it's even beyond that a new human organism or a new human being. I think where the rubber really meets the road in terms of the policy debates is the question of personhood. Is that human being that forms at that instant of sperm egg fusion the subject of rights?
Mm-hmm.
And that is actually a quite not a scientific question. It's a much more of an ethical question. But I think we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves. So how do we know that cell that forms, that's a new cell?
Yes.
How do we know that cell is a human being rather than just a human cell?
So this can be a scientific question to try and adjudicate that.
It is. And the easiest sort of most intuitive way of thinking about it is to look at the processes that a cell is undergoing and ask whether are those processes, those molecular cascades and interactions and chemical reactions that are occurring, are those processes ordered towards the health and maintenance of the cell as a cell, which would be true of any human cell in your body at any point in time, or are they pointed towards something bigger? Are they pointed towards the production and organization or structuring of new cells that are going to contribute to increasingly mature stages of the human body, of the human form?
Right.
So that process, the process of pointing forward to increased maturation, is the process of development. Mm-hmm. And I think the scientific evidence is absolutely unambiguous on this front, that within the first 1 to 3 seconds, that newly formed cell initiates a molecular cascade that can only make sense as part of a developmental process, as something that is ordered towards making new cells that are going to interact with each other to producing increasingly more mature stages of human development.
So from a scientific perspective,
yes,
as a scientist forming an opinion on this, you would say that because there is now evidence of this development, not of maintenance, but of development,
yes,
the best scientific answer you can give about that at that moment when the egg and the sperm fuse into a new cell is that this is now a human being because of its orientation towards its development.
Correct.
Okay. And is this the place where a good deal of conflict comes in, whether that is true or not?
I actually don't think that it does. I
mean, okay.
I think there are lots of people who will make assertions that mm-hmm. nobody knows, or that you can't really describe a developing human embryo as a human being until some later period in time, until consciousness or until...
Does it have to do with self-sufficient? Like the organism has become self-sufficient? Because if we're looking for that...
Well, then that would be, I don't know, age
never?
25 or something.
Maybe. Yeah, right. I don't know any 25-year-olds who are actually self-sufficient. They think they are. Yeah.
They think they are. That's correct.
Right.
So those kinds of arguments, I think, are compelling because the conclusion that a single cell, that little one-celled embryo is a human being, is a pretty tough pill to swallow, even for pro-life people, because we look at that thing and it doesn't seem to us to have the equivalence in terms of value that a more mature individual would have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's that emotional revolt that people have when they consider the question of rights that drives a lot of this debate over mm-hmm. the value of the embryo and whether or not, and it's simpler to term that or to couch that in terms of, is it a human being yet? Rather than, well, we know it's a human being, but does it have value?
Ah, I see. You're listening to Church Life Today and Redeemer Radio. We're talking with Dr. Maureen Kondik, Professor of Neurobiology and Anatomy at the University of Utah, member of the National Science Board and the Pontifical Academy for Life, and the St. Albert Award Lecturer at the 2019 Annual Conference of the Society of Catholic Scientists. So it seems to me in what you were just saying that part of the question there is, what are you looking for if you're trying to come to an opinion about whether this is human life, not just human life, but human life that has value? There's a prior question before you even come to what you're actually seeing in a microscope. What would you consider a valuable human life?
Yeah.
Or not a valuable human life, a human life that's endowed with value, let's say.
Yeah. And I think this is a question that scientists never look straight at in most circumstances, because it's not part of our training. People don't, in the scientific mindset, we don't ask the question of what something really is, what its ontological nature is, so much as we ask the question, what can I do with it? How can I manipulate it? What's it made out of?
Right.
So we describe things, but answering that what is it question, you know, is it a human person? Does it have rights? Those are not scientific questions.
They're philosophical questions in some regard.
Yes.
They're potentially theological questions, ethical questions.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's a nice point to kind of move to talking about one of your works, a book that you wrote with your brother, who is a philosopher. You as a scientist, he is as a philosopher. It's a 2018 book called Human Embryos, Human Beings, A Scientific and Philosophical Approach. So
yes.
To bring in the philosophical questions and scientific inquiry. In some ways, it's a complex book, but in other ways, it's very readable and a very readable book that's oriented towards the education of a general public. So without getting into too much of what the book does, because the point would be to read the book, which is what people should do, let me ask this. Why do you think it was important to take this approach, to have a scientist and a philosopher coming together to ask this question of human embryos, human beings, what is life, when is life, what value to life?
Well, I think it's incredibly important, and I actually think the book is a pretty unique example of this kind of a collaboration, mm-hmm. because both philosophers and scientists are talking about the same world and trying to describe it in an accurate and analytic framework.
Mm-hmm.
I think, nonetheless, there's a lot of confusion both within philosophical circles and within scientific circles about what the other side is saying, because we don't have a common language. The hardest part of writing this book was probably the 3 years in advance where we worked out terminology.
Between siblings, no less.
Between
right?
siblings, yes. It was. We used to joke and call it the Rosetta Stone of, you know, scientific to philosophical language. And it took me years to figure out that when my brother says the word matter, he's talking about something very, very different than what I understood matter to be. So we did that, though, and I think we mutually educated each other and came to a common way of thinking about and talking about both the philosophical insights and the philosophical arguments, as well as the insights that came from science and the arguments that were based on science. And surprisingly, both sides were warranting a lot of criticism for the kinds of arguments that were put forward, either because of scientific naivete or inaccuracies, or alternatively because of sloppy and inconsistent philosophical understandings of what they were talking about.
Mm. Are there ways in which you as a scientist and now rigorously engaging with a philosopher in a whole, not a different way of thinking, but a complementary way of thinking, a distinctive way of thinking, did you see ways in which this sharpened or improved or called into question the kind of science you were doing or how you would do it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of things I had never considered as interesting or critical lines of experimentation suddenly became very, very important, because the analysis that my brother and I did in the course of writing the book helped me to focus on sort of key questions that could be addressed by science but had not actually been addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, some things that I had great anxiety about, oh my gosh, you know, my colleagues are going to go off and do some horrible Mengele kind of experiment, actually philosophically probably were not as threatening as I had originally felt they were.
Hmm.
So yeah, I believe it was an excellent education for me, and I can't speak for my brother, but I hope it was a symmetrical experience for him.
Well, I imagine that's part of the process of writing the book, is I can't speak for my brother, and he has to say, I can't speak for my sister. We have to allow each other to speak. So that book came out in 2018, but another it's come out in 2019 that you also wrote with your brother. Can you tell us a little about that?
Actually, that book I'm a single author on.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that one was also
It's kind of taking one of the most compelling arguments that we address in the book that I wrote with my brother, mm-hmm. is this notion of delayed hominization based on the twinning argument.
Okay.
So many people, both Catholic theologians as well as biologists, have argued that because a human embryo is capable of producing an identical twin up until the 14th day of development, that prior to that point, you can't have a single human individual, because you can't have one entity that could be both one person and also two people.
So the view is that because there seems to be some kind of indeterminacy in these 14 days, whether it is one organism or will potentially become two as a twin, therefore you can't say it's a full-blown human organism beforehand, because it hasn't been determined. Okay.
So that is, I think, of all of the many arguments for viewing early embryos as something other than a human being,
yes.
a human individual, that is actually probably the strongest argument.
Okay.
So we did address it in the book, but that analysis prompted me to kind of broaden my thinking about the question, and also to roll in the converse question, which is the question of human chimerism. So there are situations in which two embryos can fuse together to produce a single embryo.
Oh.
that has a mix of cells within it from that derive from each of the original two embryos. And this can even happen for fraternal twins. So male and female, a brother and sister, as early embryos can fuse to produce a single individual who has 50% male cells and 50% female cells, but is still born as a single individual who will have certain kinds of medical problems associated with the fact that they have this strange cellular composition.
Right.
But it does happen. So what does that mean for our view of early embryos and for their individuality and for the question of ensoulment? When does a unique human soul exist if these kinds of biological events can happen? So I did write an entire book on the topic of twinning. It's called Untangling Twinning. I can't remember what the subtitle is. Totipotency, Individuality, and the Value of Human Embryos.
But Untangling Twinning, if you remember, that's what will pop up on Amazon. I imagine you can't lay out the entire argument here. This sounds like an incredibly complex case, but what is the basic contours of how you address that?
I think the basic contours of how it has to be addressed, first off, there's a lot of scientific inaccuracy in the way people couch these arguments. So I do my best to kind of clean up the playing field, making sure we're all talking about reality rather than imagination. And then I think one of the central keys to understanding what is happening with twinning, an adequately complex understanding of the term potential. So we use that word all the time. You know, oh, my son has the potential to become the president of the United States, or maybe a fireman, or maybe a ballerina. And yet, none of those things are actual.
Okay.
So, and maybe my son has no interest in being a ballerina, and therefore his potential on that front is somewhat different from the fact that he's fascinated with fire trucks and actually would love to become a fireman.
Right.
So it's a very fuzzy term, and people use it in a very fuzzy way. But if you appeal back to the way the term potency is used in classical philosophic literature, we have potency that can exist on two intersecting domains. So there's active and passive potency. So the active potency is the ability of something, of whatever it is we're inferring potency to do something right now. Passive potency is the ability that exists currently in that thing to be acted upon by something else in a specific way. So I have the active potency to speech even if I'm silent. Because everything I need to speak exists inside of me, and I don't need anybody else to do anything to make that happen. A chunk of wood has the passive potency to be acted upon by a carpenter to make a chair.
Right.
Okay. But a glass of water does not.
Right.
You know, water cannot be fashioned into a chair even by the most skilled carpenter.
Right.
So without something changing about the water.
That's right.
So active and passive, and then proximate and remote. So the proximate potency is, for example, my capacity to speak. And it can either be active or passive, right? So we can have the passive proximate potency of a piece of wood to be acted upon by a carpenter, and the active proximate potency of me to speak even if I'm silent.
Right.
Remote potency is something that exists either actively or passively, but something has to happen first. So if I look at a little seedling, you know, that's 3 days old of an oak tree, it has the potency to be acted upon by a carpenter, but it's both remote and passive. So it has to grow up first to make
to
wood and bark and have, you know, not just a little bendy green shoot in order for its passive potency to be expressed. And if I look at a baby who hasn't learned how to speak yet, he has a remote but active potency to speech because something has to happen first. He has to learn, acquire language before he can speak. But everything he needs to do that, unless he has a medical problem of some sort, is intrinsic to him. Okay, so let's take all of that, active and passive, remote and proximate, and go back to the embryo. An embryo is an embryo because it's exhibiting an active proximate potency to development. That's what makes it a human being.
Right.
So intrinsic to itself, it doesn't need anything to happen. It doesn't need any information from the outside. It has everything other than nutrition and oxygen and things that all living things need. A sufficiently supportive environment, but it has everything internal to it right now to be a single human individual. That's what makes it a single human individual. If twinning happens, it's revealing a active but remote potency of a part of the embryo to become a whole intact embryo. So if an intervening event occurs, the splitting of that embryo, each of the two halves now is liberated to express what is only a remote potency to be independent humans themselves.
I see.
So at no point in time are there two humans kind of coexisting inside, because
secretly,
right, yes, observed, like two souls waiting, right, you know, right, waiting to come out. What you're observing in twinning is a single embryo, which is an embryo because of its active proximate potency to develop as a human being to a more mature stage of a single human being, and that the parts of that embryo have a active remote potency to become two individuals. So the kind of potency that exists in that embryo are different with respect to being one or being two.
That was incredibly clear. Like, I followed you the entire way, which, no, I mean, honestly, like, this is a complex thing, but even in the way that you were describing that, I'm seeing the pictures and I'm following the line of argument. So when you introduced what the problem was, it was just a cloud of confusion to me. Like, my goodness, this is such a difficult problem. I can't imagine how you would go about untangling, as you say, this twinning, but just listening to it, it's done. And I can only imagine in reading it how much clearer it would be still.
Well, thank you. I hope it's helpful, because I think this is really a very compelling argument for many, many, many people. I mean, you know, it was originally introduced by Clifford Grobstein in the 1980s in support of IVF, saying we really weren't working on human embryos because they're not really human embryos until after the 14th day. They're only pre-embryos. And then it got a lot of support from Father Norman Ford, who wrote a book, When Did I Begin?, that pretty much followed the same kind of argumentation based on the idea of twinning and on this kind of muddled understanding of what potency really looks like.
And it moves from these sort of theories into hardened belief into...
Everybody knows.
Everybody knows into policy and all that stuff. You're listening to Church Life Today and Redeemer Radio. We're talking with Dr. Maureen Kondik, professor of neurobiology and anatomy at the University of Utah, member of the National Science Board and the Pontifical Academy for Life, and the St. Albert Award lecturer at the 2019 annual conference at the Society of Catholic Scientists. Well, just in what you've shared with us in terms of seeing this sort of complexity, but it also sounds like beauty of the development of a human embryo, and that really, you know, the development of a human being over the course of a lifetime. I wonder, as a scientist, how has your appreciation of human life changed through your years and years of research, of study?
Well, I have to say, I have had a long-standing fascination and love for the embryo. It's been something I entered into studying very, very early in my academic career and have kept up with ever since. Honestly, my scientific understanding didn't alter my view of humans so much as my experience of actually becoming a mother. I almost had too much information during pregnancy. I was aware of every conceivable thing that could go wrong.
And at every precise day,
yeah. And that experience really brought into reality what I had been studying academically for so long and helped me to appreciate just the miraculous side of human development, that it's almost unbelievable that we ever have any normal humans born when there are so many opportunities for things to go wrong. And yet, you know, we do. And it's really quite a extraordinary experience. So I have incredible gratitude for my beautiful children and for all the other humans I see marching about based on having been through that myself.
It reminds me of this essay by chemist, Italian Jew Holocaust survivor Primo Levi. I don't know if you know this, but in his collection of essays called The Periodic Table, I think it's the last essay in there, is on carbon. And he traces one particular bit of carbon all throughout its life cycle and where it goes and what it does. And he says, tracing this, he said, if it didn't happen on the order of, you know, billions of times every day, what happens with an atom of carbon, you would actually almost by right have to call it a miracle. But because it happens so frequently, like, we would be absolutely abhorred by that sort of language. I'm reminding of that as what you're saying in the development of any human embryo into any human being. We lose the fascination with it because it seems to happen so often. And then from one side, you hear it's happening far too often. We're overpopulated. But I love what you're talking about in terms, it wasn't the science, it was your experience of a mother, and then thinking about all of the development that's happening, and how can you but, if you pay attention to the one individual life, call it anything but a miracle that all of this happens.
Yeah, it is. It's really quite extraordinary. And I think this is one of the things that we lose as scientists, because we have so much power to manipulate, to take apart, to focus on some minute element of development and understand it in painful, excruciating detail.
Right.
You do lose the wonder because there's a false sense of control. You know, that we because we understand something, therefore it isn't actually as miraculous as it is. But it's the accumulation of so many improbable events that have to be in place and consistently there in order for everything to play out as it should. That is really quite miraculous.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time, this really terrific conversation. I wonder if I can ask you just at the end, you know, many people like myself who aren't trained scientists and who we often feel intimidated by having enough scientific knowledge to have a well-formed opinion about something, especially when it comes to policy, or even if we have a conviction to be able to defend that conviction with scientists or scientific research, because it seems like we're always coming up against somebody who knows more science than we do, and we're in a defensive position about holding a claim.
Yeah.
For people like me, what would you say are maybe the first step in becoming more scientifically literate, to developing confidence and competence?
Mm-hmm. It's a tough question because it's the body of scientific knowledge is so huge, the vocabulary is so intimidating. Yeah. It's changing constantly. And as you say, there's always somebody who can throw language at you that leaves you confused and perplexed and you don't even know what to respond.
Right? Yeah.
But I think it's very, perhaps making an analogy to engineering is helpful. So if you were on a county board trying to determine whether or not a bridge should be put across a creek at a particular place. Mm-hmm. Of course, you would hire experts who are going to do all the structural analysis and the soil analysis and all of the technical details. How much of that do you really need to know?
Mm.
Honestly?
Mm-hmm. Not that much.
Not that much. Because you can trust them.
Yeah.
But only within their domain of competence. So you ask the engineer, can the bridge be built safely? And how much is it going to cost? And then you tell him to please sit down.
Uh-huh.
And we go to now the traffic engineers and the development planners and say, all right, well, what's your view of how, is this the right place to put a bridge? What are the commuting patterns look like and blah, blah, blah.
This will be the impact for the surrounding communities, which isn't their domain to answer whether you should make that impact.
So, then we have the urban planners and we get their answer about their best assessment of impact and everything else. And then we have them sit down. And then we go to the budgeting people.
Yeah.
And what is our tax revenue look like?
Yeah.
And if we build this bridge, are we going to be able to pull in, you know, more tax income? What's your best? And we have them sit down. And now you as the member of the board have the information you need and you have it at the level you need it. And yes, you know, you don't have to know structural calculus in order to really understand what the engineer just told you.
Mm-hmm.
And if he wants to intimidate you, he can pull out his integrals and differential equations and, you know, all sorts of mechanical considerations that are going to flummox you and go completely over your head. They would certainly go over my head.
Yeah.
But I don't need that information.
For your responsibility.
What my responsibility is, right?
Yeah.
And not dig deeper than you need to dig.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I think we're going to have people writing into the show asking if they can persuade you to run for public office now, because your vision of how that all works is very persuasive. We've been talking to Dr. Maureen Kondik of the University of Utah, professor of neurobiology and anatomy there. The two books that we mentioned of hers, one co-authored with her brother, Human Embryos, Human Beings, A Scientific and Philosophical Approach, and her own book, single author, Untangling Twinning. We talked about those two books throughout, so please look for those books. Dr. Kondik, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to everyone out there for joining us on Church Life today.